Every president and presidential candidate has an economic advisor. But how influenced are these positions by politics? Economic advisors deal with many important questions. How well can we help the economy run? How close to full employment can we actually be? Can we avoid inflation and deflation? How can we move the U.S. economy for longer-term growth, say 20, 30 years from now? And of course, how do we avoid an economic crisis? I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Intro Standard, we'll hear what the appointed presidential economic advisors of the past several decades have in common, be they advisors of Barack Obama or George Herbert Walker Bush. We're also going to talk about the key roles of economic advisors as we approach yet another presidential election season. We're joined today by local economics professor superstar William Black. That's all ahead on Central Standard following this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. How a president chooses an economic advisor can have lasting effects on economic policy, especially when a succession of presidential candidates and presidents keep choosing the same people. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. I'm joined by William Black, professor of law and economics here at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You recently wrote about presidential candidate Mitt Romney's selection of his lead economist, who happens to be Gregory Mankiw, who was also a lead economic advisor for George W. Bush. He should be a household name by now, right?
That would be good. We should have a hall of scoundrels, people who caused the crisis, and he would have a prominent bust in that.
So why should we care about Gregory Mankiw's selection at this stage in an election?
Well, two reasons. One, what it tells you about Mankiw, and two, what it tells you about Romney.
What does his selection have in common with presidents of the last 20 years?
They have chosen for failure. They choose economic advisors who have gotten the principal things wrong and have produced a whole series of crises. And as a result, the crises keep getting worse.
And they keep choosing the same succession of people, the people that were in the Clinton administration, such as Lawrence Summers, also advised President Obama, and the people in the Bush administration are now talking to the Romney team.
Romney's principal economic advisor is Greg Mankiw, who is a professor of economics at Harvard, writes one of the big textbooks hundreds of thousands worldwide have read this textbook. And Mankiw was the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers under President Bush, was the architect of much of the disaster. And if you're the apparent presidential nominee, you can get pretty much any economist in America would be very happy to give you advice. So why would you go to on anybody's short list of the five worst economists in the world?
And speaking of which, you don't particularly let the Clinton appointees or the Barack Obama appointees for economic advisors off the hook either.
Oh, no. They did the exact same thing. So Robert Rubin under Clinton set the stage with the disastrous deregulation. Got rid of the Glass-Steagall Law and were eager to get the Commodities Future Modernization Act, which has created the regulatory black hole for credit default swaps that promptly led to the California energy crisis, that fraud, and to AIG's failure. And what do? We take Rubin's protege, Larry Summers, and make him Obama's principal economic advisor. And, he's every bit as bad as Rubin was. And there's something else. In addition to track record of failures, Mankiw, we call it Mankiw morality. So Mankiw was the discussant. That's a formal role when somebody's doing an academic paper. So he or she reads it in advance and thinks carefully and prepares remarks to discuss this paper in front of a important academic audience. And the paper was George Akerlof and Paul Romer's paper about what caused the savings and loan crisis. So it's a really important paper. for this subject, and they famously said that fraud was a sure thing and that economists hadn't been able to figure this out because they had no theory of fraud, but now they did. Now we know better, and we don't have to repeat the mistakes. And Mankiw's response to this article, and the title of the article says it all, Looting the Economic Underworld of Bankruptcy for Profit. So the CEO loots the bank fails, the CEO walks away wealthy. Mankiw's response, as discussant, was it would be irrational for the CEO not to loot.
So it was a sort of Gordon Gekko defense, greed is good. Sort of.
Well, except greed is good where it destroys the world. I mean, it's most insane thing because Akerlof and Romer had shown that this kind of fraud drove the crisis and caused catastrophic losses, not just to the savings and loan, but to the whole system, and showed that it hyperinflated financial bubbles. In other words, exactly what could have avoided this crisis. And Mankiw is so morally crippled that his response was, well, you know, if you don't loot when you have a chance to do so, you're not moral. You're insane. So we put him in charge. And Larry Summers has a similar thing. In one of his most prominent faculty members at Harvard, Andre Schleifer, pled nolo contendere, that means no contest, that's the equivalent of a guilty plea, to defrauding the United States of America. And they took no action against him. They left him in charge of the most prestigious economic journal in the world. A fraud, who was, by the way, you know, part of the whole process where all these group of folks were defrauding Russia. So it was a fraud against both the United States and connected to frauds against Russia.
So, Professor Black, what does an economic advisor typically advise the president on? What is an economic advisor supposed to advise a U.S. president on?
Well, there are two positions these days. One is the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, and that person is supposed to be like the lead economic guru, sort of academic-ish in that they're supposed to be giving straight advice as opposed to pure political advice. But that's, you know, huge amounts of salt because you can read any annual report of the Council of Economic Advisors, and they're always, you know, biased, whatever the administration is, whatever the party is, and such. And then there's another advisor position, and that title changes, but it's a council, and it's more sort of like a direct report to the president. And that's helping him or her structure the economic policies with their political implications fully considered. So those are the two slots. And then there's a third context, and that is what happens when you're doing it for the candidate before he's elected to office. And that one's the ultra political, right? So yes, you're giving them economic advice and cover, but you're a really important member of their political team. And everything you do is shaped by trying to get the person elected.
What are the key areas where the top advisors in the math problem parlance actually show their work?
Well, I mean, there are one principal thing, right? And that is, do you prevent the really massive economic crises, right? Because they don't have to occur. Yes, there's a business cycle, but you don't have to have a great recession. And so that's your principal function as an economist. Beyond that, of course, it's how well can you help the economy run? How close to full employment can you be? Can you avoid really serious inflation? Those type of things. And how do you move the economy now for the longer term? How do you make a stronger America 20, 30 years out? What should we be thinking about now? So that's more like the Council of Economic Advisors function, right? Those are folks are supposed to be thinking longer term than just the straight politics.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. We're joined today by William Black, a professor of law and economics at UMKC. So, Professor Black, how have some of the past selections of economic advisors from past presidents mattered? How have they shaped economic policy over the years?
Well, for example, Greg Mankiw, who was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President George W. Bush, and is a professor of economics at Harvard and the author of one of the leading textbooks that tons and tons of students worldwide learn their economics or basic economics from. His big thing was in sort of an odd fit because Bush was busy arguing that deficits didn't matter and therefore you could have this huge tax cut for the rich and it didn't matter that the budget deficit was likely to increase. And so he was trying to argue that, well, it probably won't really increase because we'll spur the economy so much that we'll have a surplus. Mankiw didn't believe that. He's not a supply-sider. In fact, he said really disparaging things about supply-siders. So he signed on to something that he didn't believe in, and then he was in a position where he couldn't really deny it. You see the function where you have to be the good soldier because you shouldn't take the position if you can't support the president in his biggest policy. So there was an odd disconnect under Bush, under which Bush's primary macroeconomic policy was not something that Mankiw really supported, but he had to nominally support it in his public utterances.
But now Mankiw is back.
Mankiw is back. And the big thing Mankiw did was ignore all of the crisis coming. So I went back and read the annual reports of the Council of Economic Advisors under Mankiw. And problem? What problem? Instead of being worried about the housing bubble, they were busy being in denial that there could be such a thing as a housing bubble. It was all great. So he's tried to recast himself after the crisis as someone who was warning. He was doing the opposite. He was someone encouraging the kind of loans that blew up the economy. The other thing that he was noted for and that the incoming Bush administration was noted for, there was a big effort by the industrial nations. These are the OECD nations is what they're called. So these are the roughly the 20 biggest economies, to crack down on tax havens. Because tax havens, of course, are places where all kinds of people
hide their money, right?
Hide their money, avoid taxes. But this is also where they launder money. So this is the mobs and this is terrorists and such. And it also means it's very hard to have an appropriate level of taxes to support your services. So it was tending to lead to long-term deficits and such. All right. So that was the logic. And they were making huge progress. And they were going to crack down. And then President Bush was elected. And even before he got into office, there was a big effort among economic advisors to make sure that the Bush administration would kill the OECD effort. And so they did, which was the greatest boon to the drug smugglers, you know, the tax evaders and the terrorists. And what happened, of course, was the 9/11 attacks. And, you know, the 9/11 attacks, people may have heard about all these secret hawala mechanisms for moving money and such. That's not how, what happened. The terrorists were funded through tax havens. And so the Bush administration was deeply embarrassed and had to unwind some of its opposition.
Are you saying, Professor Black, that Gregory Mankiw's policy on tax havens for the rich is in some way directly related to the tax havens that terrorists use and the financial flow of
absolutely
money?
Tax havens are inherently unethical. They go to, I mean, they in the race to the bottom, they are the below the bottom. They're the sub-basement of life. And so they will take and support anybody's money over time. And most expressly, they will take terrorist money. And that is indeed how al-Qaeda got the money to the terrorists in the United States, is through offshore tax havens. So the action in blocking the OECD effort to crack down on the tax havens was a clear and present danger to the national security of the United States of America.
Are you saying that a lack of regulation of tax havens, to use a popular phrase that was used around that time, helps the terrorists win?
Yes. It does help the terrorists fund attacks on the United States and other nations. But Mankiw was one of those theorists that said it's great to have tax havens, because tax havens make it very difficult to have any significant corporate income tax. Because if they do, the corporations will just move to the tax haven. And he hated taxes, right? He wanted lower taxes. So that was his thing. And he's just done an op-ed a few days ago in the New York Times in which he endorses this competition argument again. So he's learned absolutely nothing from it. We did it once. It was a disaster. And so he wants to come back and do it again.
And now he's advising Romney.
And now he's advising Romney. And that's an interesting point because, of course, it's sort of a wonkish argument, right? Why you get in the New York Times and you argue about why government should compete with other governments. Not exactly a subject that, you know.
What does that even mean?
Well, yeah. What it means in this context was I'll have a lower interest rate. A lower tax rate than you. So you shall locate your companies in my country. And I'll have weaker regulations than you. So you should regulate your – you should move your financial sector to our weak regulation. So this is called the competition in laxity. And I was wondering why – if you get in the New York Times, why are you running this kind of really wonkish type stuff? And then I thought, well, Romney, Bain Capital. How did Bain Capital largely make its money?
Through leveraged buyouts and private equity.
And putting desperate state and local governments in competition with each other. You provide me with a tax subsidy or I'll close the plant and move it elsewhere. And so Bain, as a private equity takeover artist, got all kinds of subsidies from state and local governments by putting them in competition. So it's actually the perfect argument for defending and for creating the mechanism that makes the Romneys of the world rich. And what is a Romney famous for? And what is he politically vulnerable? Because he has offshore accounts in the Cayman Islands, big ones, for a long time, and he won't tell anybody why he has them. And the most obvious thing is that it's a means of tax evasion.
So as usual, Professor Black, it's all connected.
It turns out to be all connected. And beyond that, remember, his metaphor is competition among government is similar to competition among businesses. It makes them better. But that's not true typically in the governmental context. When you and I as governments compete in laxity, we produce a disaster. And he cites the framers of our Constitution in the article, and that's really weird because the reason we have the Constitution instead of the Articles of Confederation, which is what we originally had, was because there was so much destructive competition
among
the states that it destroyed commerce. So, I mean, he's ignored the real history of the United States or invented a new one for himself.
Here's a question about Romney and his ties to private equity and Bain Capital. Why is it bad to make money?
It's not bad to make money. The question is how you make your money. And if you make your money by putting governments in competition for laxity, to reduce standards, to give specialized tax breaks so that some people, the very wealthy and elites, can avoid taxes, then you first cause obvious fiscal problems for the country, but you also are setting yourself on the road to crony capitalism.
And do states then become almost like competing foreign governments against each other as well?
Not almost, very much like it, except that they ultimately can't compete with the Cayman Islands of the world. And that's where, of course, Romney has, I think, unique in my experience for any presidential candidate, he has apparently large offshore accounts that he won't tell us why they exist.
How does taxing people in Mitt Romney's tax bracket, you know, the executive class, the so-called 1%, how does that affect middle class and poor people in this country?
Well, under the existing mantra, which we don't necessarily think is correct under modern monetary theory, the view is that you've got to make up the money elsewhere. And if you don't get it from the elites, you got to get it from people who are poorer. And this is the whole concept of the Buffett rule. So Mankiw's claim is that he's in favor of competition in laxity because it makes government better, right? Just like when businesses compete. But there was a really good test of this under the Bush administration, and that is some states began competing not in laxity but in vigor. Some of them tried to crack down on the frauds, the mortgage frauds, and the predatory lending that were producing the crisis. How did the Bush administration respond? It responded by using federal preemption to prevent any such competition in vigor, to keep the lowest possible standard. And did Greg Mankiw, as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, opposed that preemption, saying, oh, no, you're stopping competition among government. How terrible. No, that was just fine with him. So when he says he wants the competition, no, he wants the laxity that the competition produces. If it produces vigor in regulation, he hates it.
Let's talk about the other side of the aisle, which
yes.
you do not let off the hook with.
No, not at all.
Lawrence Summers, who had ties to Citigroup and also was a Harvard intellectual, president of Harvard, and had ties to Harvard just like Greg Mankiw. What is that story?
So
that's from the Clinton and Obama lineage. What's that economic policy story?
Yeah, you are absolutely right. I mean, I'm scorching about the Democrats' choice of economic advisors for very similar reasons to what I've been describing with Greg Mankiw and the Republican side. So Clinton's famous economic guru was Robert Rubin. And Robert Rubin, of course, was Goldman Sachs. And one of his, in essence, proteges was Larry Summers, an economist connected with Harvard already, who will then, when he leaves government, become the president of Harvard, so the chief guy. And he got into troubles about his approach to women and such. But what he really got in trouble with the faculty was that a very prominent economist, Andre Schleifer, who was editor of the most prestigious economic journal in the world, pled nolo contendere, that means no contest, which is the legal equivalent of pleading guilty for most purposes, to the charge of having defrauded the United States of America in conjunction with a series of grants where the argument was that there was major defrauding of the Russian government, and the you know, after the fall of the Soviet Union. And Summers took no action. I mean, the guy admits to defrauding the United States of America, and we leave him in this incredibly prestigious position. So like Mankiw, Summers has this very weak morality, and Geithner. Now, Geithner, let's credit his story. His story is he used TurboTax wrong, and so he didn't pay taxes that he needed to pay when he was getting a lot of money at the World Bank, right? He was a very rich person. Fine. But then he's nominated or about to be appointed to run the Federal Reserve Bank of
New York,
where, by the way, he was a disaster as a regulator, complete failure. We keep promoting failures.
Is that just to stop you for a second, is that the overlying pattern, economic policy advisors and people in sort of a revolving door of Treasury, Secretary and Cabinet positions and positions in the Federal Reserve that come in and out of the banking community and that foster this sort of pattern of economic degradation? Is that what you're arguing?
Yeah, they are have this pattern of failure, and they're made rich when they leave, and they do the will of finance while they're there. So they're valuable precisely because they're willing to give the wrong answers.
And then they're summoned back by political successors, as we see with Gregory Mankiw and Mitt Romney, or as we see with Lawrence Summers and Obama.
Yeah, sometimes it just doesn't work when you flush.
Why do the same guys keep getting picked over and over again by administration after administration, despite different political ideology, despite, you know, what we've seen as disaster results?
Because the finance industry loves them. And the finance industry loves them because they're willing to give the wrong answers in economics, answers that we've known for decades don't work and produce a disaster, but which make not finance even necessarily, but the CEOs and the senior executives incredibly wealthy. Right. So, yes, Geithner, to finish the tax story, is told you did your taxes wrong. You owe a lot of money, but not a lot compared to his wealth. He refused to do so. He's going to be appointed to one of the most prominent financial positions in America, one of the most important. The Federal Reserve Bank is more equal by far than any other Federal Reserve Bank.
In New York.
The Federal Reserve Bank of New York is far more important than any of the other 11 Federal Reserve Banks, right? So it's a really, really ultra elite position. And we put a guy in who knows he owes taxes and refuses to pay them. Why? Because he can get away with it. It's past the statute of limitations. Now, that's what ethics is all about, what we do when people aren't looking or we think we can get away with them. And he only paid those taxes when he was made Treasury Secretary. It was made clear to him politically that unless he paid the taxes, he would never get through the advice and consent of the Senate. And, of course, what is his job now? Among his job functions now, he runs the IRS, which is a Bureau of Treasury.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Javelani LaFall, joined today by William Black, a professor of law and economics here at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. We've been talking about economic advisors to past presidents and presidential candidates. We're going to take a quick break. More when we return. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Javelani LaFall, joined today by William Black, a professor of law and economics at UMKC. We've been talking about economic advisors to presidents and presidential candidates and how this revolving door effect plays out with these executive branch appointments. Kansas City, tell us what you think about the direction of U.S. economic policy. What concerns you most? Head over to our website at kcur.org. and leave a comment. You can also join the ongoing conversation on KCUR's Facebook page. And our Twitter handle here at Central Standard is at KCURCST. As a fellow economist, Professor Black, would you want the job of being an economic advisor for a president?
That's never going to happen. Thousands of economists could die and I would not be made.
But whether or not it's going to happen or not, would you, was the question.
That would not be a good slot for me. A good slot for me would be as a regulator and such. You want a macroeconomist in that position, and I most assuredly am nothing like a macroeconomist. So Randy Ray, Stephanie Kelton from my colleagues here at UMKC long before me.
We've been talking about Gregory Mankiw and his role with the Bush administration, and now his role, his burgeoning role as an economic advisor for Mitt Romney. You've met him. What do you think of him?
Well, I have.
What was your impression?
And the context was he was the discussant, the formally chosen discussant, which means you read the paper intensively in advance and prepare your comments. And the paper was by George Akerlof and Paul Romer. It's back in 1993. And the title of it is Looting the Economic Underworld of Bankruptcy for Profit. And they showed how looting drove a whole series of financial crises, including the savings and loan debacle. And they concluded the article by saying, hey, economists weren't at all helpful. The examiners in the field recognized this looting immediately, but we gave them no help. We economists gave them no help because we had no theory of fraud. Now we know better. And if we learn from the mistakes of the past, we don't have to have this kind of crisis ever again, right? So, and they said fraud is a sure thing and the weapon of choice is accounting. And they said these kind of frauds, when they come together, can hyperinflate a financial bubble. In other words, they foreshadowed the current crisis brilliantly. And if Mankiw had learned anything from reading the article, we could have avoided it entirely, the crisis. Instead, Mankiw's response was to say it would be irrational for CEOs of SNLs not to loot their institutions. And the reason it'd be irrational is because you could get away with it. And so from his perspective, if you had an opportunity to defraud, to breach all of your fiduciary duties to shareholders and get rich personally by destroying your shareholders.
That you should do it early and often.
If you failed to do it, you were not moral. You were insane. You were irrational. And yes, his answer was the Chicago answer, you know, in terms of voting. Vote early, vote often. It was steal early, steal often.
So why do you think Mitt Romney is tapping Mankiw for advice then?
Well, again, for the reason, first, Mankiw will say basically whatever needs to be said, and he will write whatever needs to be written to try to defend all of the vulnerabilities. So some of those vulnerabilities are that Romney has gotten rich through Bain Capital by putting desperate state and localities in competition with each other, saying, give me big tax subsidies so I don't have to pay taxes at this plant, or I'll shut it down and move it somewhere else.
So he's being brought in to put the spin on that.
Put spin on that. And Romney is vulnerable on taxes. So guess who's defended having a really low tax rate for Romney's class of private equity investor? Well, that would be Mankiw. And Romney's vulnerable because he's certainly the only president I've known of or candidate I've known of that had overseas deposits, right? He has overseas accounts for a long time, apparently very large, in the Cayman Islands, one of the most notorious tax havens in the world. And normally you only do that for tax evasion purposes. So why do these things exist? And guess who's defending that as well? Mankiw. So first, Mankiw is willing to say and do anything. And second, finance loves him because he hates regulation. You put Mankiw in and you will produce the same criminogenic environment that produced the last crisis. He believes in this competition in laxity on regulation, this race to the bottom of regulation that produced the equivalent. You know, we've been talking about pink slime in our meat system. Well, this is green slime, the color of money that dominates our financial system.
And speaking of green slime, you've argued during this discussion that these advisors are loved by finance pervasively. When you talk about Mankiw, when you talk about Lawrence Summers, when you talk about Robert Rubin, and the other slew of
Geithner,
Bernanke, the other slew of economic advisors or Fed chiefs that have come over the past three or four administrations. Backing up from that, looking at it from a macro point, from a 30,000-foot viewpoint, how much power does an economic advisor wield next to, say, a Treasury Secretary or a President of the Fed, both of which are nominated by the executive branch of government? Talk a little bit about the power that an economic advisor wields.
The power doesn't come from position per se. It comes from your relationship with the president and your willingness to assert power. And so Larry Summers was famous or infamous, depending on your point of view, in cutting off access of other economists to the president of the United States, in particular, Paul Volcker. So if people remember during the campaign, Paul Volcker arose as someone that the president was, A, very flattered that Paul Volcker was supporting him, and B, whenever they met, he really liked his advice. And so Summers, and this is in the books, you know, made sure that Volcker was given a rather obscure, meaningless committee assignments that kept him away. And then, you know, the president only hears Larry Summers.
Now, apropos of this conversation, Larry Summers had an advisory capacity with both the Clinton administration and the Obama administration. So when you say that he stonewalled the president and blocked Volcker from having audiences with the president or meeting with the president on a more regular basis, which president are you actually talking about?
This is under President Obama that this has happened. And again, that depends on the relative strength of the chief of staff versus the economic advisor. So, you know, sometimes the chief of staff runs that gatekeeper function almost entirely. In other cases, Baker, for example, under the first President Bush. James Baker had had a 25-year, 30-year relationship with the president, obviously before he was president and such. And he was both Treasury Secretary in one term and Chief of Staff in another term, and was the principal advisor, whatever his title was.
But Larry Summers eventually leaves the Obama administration, and Obama chooses another Clinton appointee to remain in his stead.
That's right. And after the first time, after the Clinton thing, when he goes to Harvard, Larry Summers is made wealthy. And he's made wealthy by giving these 30-minute speeches, in which in some cases he gets $180,000 from the Argentina Chamber of Commerce. Now, there's got to be a story. I don't know what the story is, but there's a story there.
Seems like a pretty sweet deal.
Because that doesn't make any sense under any normal, honest scenario in life, right? So something was going on. Somebody thought they were buying some kind of influence to do something that insane. So Larry Summers gave a whole series of talks on things that he wasn't particularly expert on. And this is how you're made wealthy in a way that could never be prosecuted.
Just kind of touring like a rock star.
Touring like a rock star. Or Rubin. Rubin goes off. Remember, he's been the head of Goldman Sachs. Then he's Treasury Secretary under Clinton. He deregulates. He is the principal advisor when Citicorp illegally purchases an entity that it could not purchase under Glass-Steagall. And then the regulators announce that they will not take any action against the illegal acquisition pending consideration of the Graham-Leach-Bliley law, which will repeal Glass-Steagall. So they wait a year with this illegal purchase by Citicorp. Eventually,
which deal are you talking about? Are you talking about the
Travelers?
Yeah, Travelers deal. Right.
And then they do, in fact, repeal it. And so Citicorp ends up with Travelers with this year in advance advantage from all of this. And where does Rubin end up? He ends up at Citigroup.
Which is now Citigroup.
Which is now Citigroup, which that makes him extremely wealthy for giving advice that was catastrophically bad. And he was one of the people. There's testimony in front of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission by the key mortgage guy at Citi that was distressed because he, you know, did internal audits like you're supposed to of the audit quality, you know, the credit quality. And they were largely selling these loans to Fannie and Freddie, he testified. And they were selling apparently in the range of $50 billion annually. So this is, you know, really big bucks. And he was distressed because he found that 60% of the loans failed to meet Citicorp's credit standards and therefore were sold under false representations and warranties. So he writes memos and he gets no support for cracking down on this. And he keeps writing memos, and he gets no support. So finally, he does a CC to Rubin at this high executive board position saying it. And then they look again, and they find that there has been a change. The fraud levels is now up to 80%.
So the end analysis here is that there seems to be a pattern of fraud. And a pattern of musical chairs with political appointees in and out of finance and back into the executive branch and then back again across administrations, across political ideologies. Who or what type of economist would bring a fresh approach to break this cycle of, you know, Rubin, Summers, and then Mankiw, and then Mankiw again, and then, you know.
Well, first, you might try people who got it right. I mean, just sort of as a weird idea, people that were successful in creating predictions and policies. So Jamie Galbraith would be the type of person that if virtually everyone dies, which is what it would take, and I was made president of the United States, I'd ask him to be my principal economic advisor.
So Galbraith would be a principal economic advisor in the Black administration.
In the Black administration. The very, very, very hypothetical Black administration.
And what would an ideal economic advisor bring to the table in your eyes?
Well, they give you straight advice without the spin, right? You shouldn't go to your economic advisor for anything involving politics. Just tell us what the country needs, right?
That's it.
And then we'll figure out on the political side how close we can get to that, right? Certainly on the political side, you have to make compromises, and, you know, no question about that if you want to get anything done. But from folks like this, you want just their absolute best advice as to how do you make the country stronger over the long term.
Speaking of that balance, do economic policymakers tend to rely too much on polling data in the political sphere and then economic data in the capital markets in making long-term decisions based on short-term numbers?
Well, they certainly make it on short-term numbers. And worse, Greenspan famously believed whatever the market said. So if, he was, before he becomes chairman of the Fed, he's one of the principal economic consultants to Lincoln Savings, the most notorious fraud in the savings and loan debacle. And he writes letters saying that Lincoln Savings poses no foreseeable risk of loss to the insurance fund, just produced the worst loss in the entire fund's history. But the reason he wrote those things is because, you know, it had a high stock market value. And he believed that fraud was impossible. Well, if you believe those things, there's no grounds for doing anything, right? You never regulate. You never need to regulate and such. So that was all madness. On a more technical basis, there these days, what we call mark to model, so your pricing doesn't come from you and me actually buying and selling things. It's what my mathematical model says my asset is worth, which really has to do with what my mathematical model says is the risk of this particular asset that doesn't really trade.
And that's the sort of logic that, you know, caused credit derivatives and mark-to-market securities and...
Well, that's the first level. The second level is your bonus depends on the values the model shows. So we call this in reality, and Buffett calls this mark to myth, right? So what would you – it's the old joke, the accountant. You know, when you're hiring accountants and you go, what's one and one? And the winning accountant bid says, what would you like it to be?
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. We're joined today by William Black, a professor of law and economics at UMKC. Professor Black, you recently wrote about green slime. What is that exactly?
Well, green slime, again, so this is a metaphor off of pink slime. So really briefly, pink slime was you took this really fatty meat that would normally only be fed to dogs, and you get rid of as much of the fat as possible, but it's still really full of germs. So you then put it in Mr. Clean, ammonia. And now that makes it smell and taste not so great. So you can only put a bit of this pink slime into the regular hamburger. And why do you put it in a hamburger? Because nobody can tell it's there. And you don't disclose that it's there. And you don't disclose that you treated it with ammonia. But as I say, it's limited to about 15% because otherwise it's hard to sell. And while it's more dangerous than regular hamburger, it's not immensely more dangerous if you put enough Mr. Clean in. And so it's not like people are getting sick all the time from having hamburger. In the financial sphere, we got green slime. And green slime
kind of
tops,
like Nickelodeon. It's from the ceiling.
Huge vats of it. And it ain't limited to 15%. So we had whole sectors that were all fraudulent, right? So liar's loans were 90% fraudulent versus 15%. And then they were put into the equivalent of hamburger with these collateralized debt obligations, which are, again, that means it's really opaque. It's the old joke about sausages, you know, in politics. If you want to eat them, don't look at what goes into them. Well, that's a funny joke when it's things that don't sound real good but are actually kind of tasty. But it's not funny when you're talking about the equivalent of pink or green slime.
And so rounding out the conversation, you're saying that this culture, this green slime culture, rolls all the way up to a succession of economic advisors across political aisles, across ideologies, and across several of our last executive administrations in this country.
Yeah. As Akerlof and Romer said, using accounting fraud is a sure thing. And the way to optimize accounting fraud is to make really, really, really crappy loans, which is to say the equivalent of green slime. And so they love systems that have extremely weak regulation, where the regulatory cops in the beat have been yanked off the beat. And then when you do that, no Mr. Clean gets added. And this stuff is really infectious. It spreads throughout the system, and it produces recurrent, intensifying financial crises. And, I mean, this isn't hard, right? They called these loans liar's loans. So where were Summers and Rubin and Mankiw and Geithner when the industry is calling them liar's loans, calling them fraudulent loans? And you have the clear authority in the Federal Reserve under the 1994 HOEPA legislation, which they eventually use, but only in effective 2009. You had the clear authority at all time to stop this, and you absolutely refuse to stop it, and where the entire finance industry doesn't want you to stop the green slime.
So how do we stop the green slime? Going forward, with a second Obama administration on the horizon and or a Romney administration with these same economic advisors in the driver's seat, how do we change the green slime? How do we clean it up? How do we keep it from falling on our proverbial faces at our People's Choice Awards?
We actually had a really nice system of rules. They were really simple, and they imposed no cost on honest businesses because any honest lender would do these things anyway. Here it is. Before you make a loan, you have to underwrite to see whether, step two, the borrower has the ability to repay the loan. And step three, you have to keep a written record that you've done this. That allows us as regulators to check, and it creates a paper trail where you either document that you knew you were making bad loans, which kind of is a hint, maybe something's wrong, or you destroy documents or forge documents, which is really clear, we put you in jail type stuff. So it is incredibly demonstrative of the problem with these economic advisors. We went through this crisis. By the way, that rule was gotten rid of by Clinton in 1993 under the rubric of reinventing government, which was a war on regulation. So why didn't we reimpose those three simple requirements?
So a mandate for economic advisors coming from the top would be to reinstitute regulation, financial regulation, from the top down, so to speak.
It would be quality success. Do what works instead of continuing to do what we know produces massive amounts of green slime.
William Black is a professor of law and economics here at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. We've been talking about presidential economic advisor appointees and their connection to green slime of financial deregulation. Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you.
Central Standard is produced by Andrea Salenzi with help from Charlie Upchurch. Kansas City, tell us what you think about the direction of U.S. economic policy. What concerns you, and what do you think of William Black's green slime metaphor? Head over to our website at kcur.org and leave a comment. We're also chatting with you on KCUR's Facebook page, and if you're not a fan yet of the Central Standard's Facebook page, you should be. And our Twitter handle is at KCURCST. Up to Date is next with the Techspurts. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and this is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.